180 years ago in 1773, Pierre Simon de la Place, then 23 years old, stood before the Academy of Sciences in Paris and read a paper, Lights, in which he proved the stability of the solar system. 1773. All deflections of the planets from their paths are only periodic oscillations, he said, from their mean courses, or their regular average course. And the celestial mechanism is wound up to go on forever. The thesis of Simon de Laplace. Laplace's contemporary, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, set out to demonstrate in a series of works that this earth has ever been an abode of peaceful evolution, free from spasmodic disturbances in opposition to the dominant views of his day. Now, each of these men lived from 1749 to 1827. Well, in that period, Lamarck lived from 1744 to 1829. Interesting messengers these men were, timed on the stage of history to pre-program, to use a Greek word, the cosmos, the worldview of things. Now, the Apostle Peter, whom God let preach the very first sermon on the day of Pentecost, was judged by Jesus to be the spokesman of Satan. When he said, "Get behind me, Satan." So I don't mean to attack the honesty or character of these scientists. Anyone has to watch that they don't become the mouthpiece of the dragon. But the timing is significant. Up until this period, cataclysms were accepted. The worldview was still open pretty much to the biblical frame, with plenty of error, but open. Satan certainly knew that the time span of 2,520 years that was rolling regarding several things in God's set times was about to end, and a burst of knowledge would appear in the archaeological and historic world, and language world that would enable the proof of God's control on history to be demonstrated. So the dragon, ever at work, began to reshape the viewpoint of the world that's dominated pretty much ever since. They were in opposition to the dominant views of their day. Now, you may think that this world frame that dominates present society has been around since Neolithic man. Not so. Very recent. These ideas of harmony or stability in the celestial and terrestrial spheres gained ground in the 19th century and became the foundation of scientific thought. In 1846, Leverrier, by announcing the existence of the planet Neptune, which was immediately thereafter discovered in the part of the sky indicated by him, proved the gravitational theory of Newton and the orderly universe of Laplace or Laplace to be correct. This theory of uniformity, as understood by Lamarck and Hutton and developed by Lyell, became the cornerstone of the Darwinian theory. And Darwin went so far as to say that anybody who was unconvinced by Lyell's teaching should refrain from reading The Origin of Species. The principle of uniformity, or the explanation of all past events in the history of the globe in terms of the processes in action in our own age, or the denial of catastrophic crises in the past, gave Darwin what he needed most for his idea, which really wasn't his. He stole it. What Darwin needed most for his idea of the origin of species, almost unlimited time, with things going on the same way. In order that from the struggle for existence or competition, new forms should evolve, and that an animal like the spider with its many legs and human beings should have had a common ancestor, untold eons were necessary. Without change. I mean, in the harmonious, do it the same way procedure. By the end of the 19th century, the war between the theory of evolution and the theory of creation in 6 days, less than 6,000 years ago, was concluded with victory to the theory of evolution. The only difficulty left was, in the view of Thomas Huxley, that no really new species had appeared on the world scene since the scientific observations were made, not even in breeding experiments. The geological record, however, spoke unequivocally of the fact in the past lived animal forms that don't live any longer. And of the forms that live in our age, many were not present in the geologic past. Laplace's theory of the origin of the solar system from a rotating nebula was replaced by the end of the century with a theory of a catastrophic beginning and a near collision of the sun with another star, with debris forming the planets. But it was stressed by the authors of this new theory that the universe is orderly, and this beginning in a cataclysm was an unusually rare occurrence in the cosmos. And that the solar system is governed by the principle of stability, as enunciated by Laplace, and the earth is governed by the law of uniformity, and the animals and plants by the law of evolution through continuity. I look or sound like a television evangelist? That's right, I'm not, so don't be stupid. Think I'm one. If you're looking for a television evangelist, turn the knob. They're good with knobs. Or try to be. It appeared that, basic principles having been established, science had before, or in front of it, only the work of refinement in observation and in the addition of details for the perfection of knowledge. But the time of basic discoveries was over. This was the outlook in 1895. In April of that year, Fridtjof Nansen, in an attempt to discover the North Pole, reached a point less than 4 degrees from it. The scientific world looked upon the discovery of the North Pole as the most coveted goal still left to be attained by science. But before Nansen, drifting from latitude 86 degrees and 14 minutes, reached his home in Norway, the scene changed. Conrad Röntgen of Würzburg discovered the X-rays, or cathode ray, that passes through opaque bodies. In the same year of 1895, 20-year-old Marconi, working at the home of his father near Bologna, made the first successful experiment with wireless transmission. We sometimes forget how much has happened in the last 100 years. My Lord, if we could live another 100 years, those that are smart among us, or 900 years. That year, too, Freud published his first paper, together with Joseph Breuer, which led to a new understanding of the realm known as the subconscious. Now, some of you probably don't know that Freud's first work was with a brewer. That could explain a lot about the subconscious. At the same time, Pavlov made his contribution to the psychology of the reflexes. That's a pretty good combination. Freud and sex, Pavlov and dogs, and a brewer in the middle. The next year, and still before Nansen had landed on the Norwegian coast, Henry Becquerel, working on uranium, discovered the phenomenon of radioactivity. 2 years later, he was followed by Curie, who discovered radium. In 1897, J.J. Thompson announced that the atom is divisible and is actually a microcosm, and he was followed by Rutherford. In 1900, Planck presented the theory of quanta, or energies dispatched in bundles or shots and not in a continuous stream. And in the field of the origin of species, in 1900, Van Vries announced mutation in plants, observed for the first time a process of spontaneous change in living nature, fundamentally different from the process of evolution through continuity as postulated by Darwin. Thus, in a few years, in a spectacular series of discoveries, the entire world, matter and energy, living species, and the human soul opened new horizons, and everything appeared to be in incessant vibration, collisions, and transformation. The macrocosm, the microcosm, and even the subtle world of the mind, all alike, facing catastrophe. In my judgment, membership in my church, if I were to put a standard on it, which I don't, Jesus accepts you, I do. I ain't interested in policing you. But if I had entrance requirements, I'd make everybody read Emmanuel Velikovsky. Take a test on it. If you understand him, you can make it. One of the most creative thinkers the world has seen. And he shook the world up. Worlds in collision. 3-part, 3-volume series, Ages in Chaos. And I'm reading from Earth in Upheaval. Not the main book, but an address before the Graduate College Forum of Princeton University on October 14, 1953. The title of the address, 1895 and 1950, The Time Was Ripe for Heresy. If I have a goal for anyone, it's to open their mind. Now, if in the process of opening the mind, I can introduce a God that isn't dumping on you all the time, who will take an open-minded person with the courage to faith and give him salvation, fine. You've added to the number of heaven that will make it attractive to be there. But I'm not trying to convert anybody. If I did what I was trained to do, I'd be teaching in a religion department or a philosophy department at a university and have a handful of students. More interested in girls than what I was talking about. By doing it on television at this late night hour, I have the privilege of teaching people who are interested. Now, that's what Gene Scott's about. Somebody called me today and said that the LA Times is going to do an in-depth story on me. My God, how many have they done? And while I was making a call to Ed Nasry about that, he's on the phone talking. CBS called. They're going to do a 5-part series on people's choices in religion. They want to feature me in some Lutheran church and Bob Shuler. Why can't I just teach and be left alone? I try to teach people how to get to heaven without being religious. Hell's going to be populated with religious people. But and in 1905, Albert, I'm reading from Earth and Upheaval, Emanuel Velikovsky and the address he gave at Princeton, which is a supplement at the end of the book. In 1905, Albert Einstein, then 26 years old, offered his understanding of the physical world, an understanding that required a new mental approach as a testimonial that the age of basic discoveries had not ended with the victory of Darwin over the book of Genesis. Now, just think about it for a minute. Can you see it now? 15,000 in the Long Beach Coliseum. Jimmy Swaggart preaching. The saints praying. And Jimmy Swaggart turns the light on for Einstein and he comes to the altar. Think of it. There's drama for you. Einstein, searching for reality. Finally, someone tells him to fly to Lynchburg. Albert Einstein, in order to get to heaven, must listen to Tammy sing and sit in a hot tub for Jesus with Jimmy. I want to tell you, if your approach to God and religion can't make an Einstein interested and comfortable and feel like God's not against him because he's got a mind that at 26 shattered the fixations of the mental set of this century, then it's an awful small God that conceived that religion. Let me say that again. If what is being presented is religion, cannot make an Einstein sit up and take notice and realize that he doesn't have to sacrifice that brain power to add an understanding of God to what he's doing, then it ain't much of a religion. And if it seems a bit incongruous that an Einstein must sit there and be bellowed at for 30 minutes by a sweating, swaggering megalomaniac in order to come to Jesus, then isn't it kind of a put down to suggest that the rest of us have to follow that route? As I said, they're all a bunch of assholes, these television evangelists. Since then, another 50 years have passed. Am I boring you? It makes no difference to a television evangelist. 50 years, 100 years, 5,000 years. They still got the same message. Nothing. Do this and don't do that. Religion or nothing, or religion or do-do. Take your choice. Since then, another 50 years have passed. Once more, as before the end of the 19th century, we are told that the fundamentals are all known. The age of basic discoveries is definitely terminated. This time for certain. And present and future generations will have to satisfy themselves with detecting details, accumulating data, and adding decimals. Details without the head. And though the exciting decade of 1895 to 1905 threw light on processes in matter, life, and soul, processes that are certainly not inert and are marked by spontaneity and conflict, science in its various branches adjusted the new discoveries and ideas to the framework of the old great principle reigning equally in lifeless, living nature, the law of harmony and unperturbed stability. That's fundamentalism. The time, he said, was ripe for heresy. I wonder if I could get CBS to run a five-part series in which they did these others, and then they said, and now we'll take a look at the joyous heretic. I think I'd go for that. The joyous heretic. Jesus was one. He was a heretic to the Pharisees. Paul was one. He was a heretic to the James crowd. Luther was one. He was a heretic to the Catholic world. Wesley was one. He was a heretic to the Anglican communion. The time was ripe for heresy. In 1950, a book, Worlds in Collision, created an outburst of emotions almost unprecedented in science. In the preface to the book, I wrote, quote, "Harmony or stability in the celestial and terrestrial spheres is the point of departure of the present-day concept of the world as expressed in the celestial mechanics of Newton and the theory of evolution of Darwin. If these two men of science are sacrosanct, this book is a heresy. And if Jimmy the Jerk and Jerry the Fat are sacrosanct, I am a heretic." leading up to something, as I usually am. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
I'm asking for cryptic responses. I notice I don't get them too well unless I'm here live. I guess even though you're being cryptic, you like to have a cryptic reader here of your cryptic responses. Ogden, Kansas. Where did he get his Ph.D.? Stanford University, 57. In what? Philosophies of education. What was his bachelor's? In history. How did he get into the ministry? I really don't know. Thanks. God called me into a wilderness of ignorance to try to provide an alternative. That's it. In 1950, don't take any more calls, a book I'm reading from Emmanuel Velikovsky, Earth in Upheaval. In 1950, a book, Worlds in Collision, created an outburst of emotions almost unprecedented in science. In the preface to the book, I wrote, I'm a rebel with a cause, by the way. Quote, harmony or stability in the celestial and terrestrial spheres is the point of departure of the present-day concept of the world as expressed in the celestial mechanics of Newton and the theory of evolution of Darwin. Harmony and stability. If these two men of science are sacrosanct, holy, this book is heresy. End quote. Velikovsky speaking in an address he made to Princeton. I came upon the idea that traditions and legends and memories of generic origin can be treated in the same way in which we treat, in psychoanalysis, the early memories of a single individual. I spent 10 years on this work. I found that the collective memory of humankind spoke of a series of global catastrophes that occurred in historical times. You know what he's saying there. You're smart. As psychoanalysis had uncovered the false impression that the tranquil personality of many people hides deep-seated traumas in their personal history, Velikovsky came upon the idea that the traditions and the legends and the myths that across the board are a part of the historic accumulation in the culture of mankind, like psychoanalysis treats the memories of a single individual, all these legends form a collective memory, he says, of humankind, which speak of global catastrophes, series of them, that occurred in historical times. I believed, Velikovsky said, that I could even identify the exact times and the very agents of the great upheavals of the more recent past. The conclusions at which I arrived compelled me to cross the frontiers in the various fields of science. And I could add to his speech, that he was coming up against a world of specialists, too, who looked at the world from their little myopic discipline. And there are very few Gestaltists around. The reason Reinhold Niebuhr was able to shake the religious world, he had a Gestaltic knowledge of just about every field and the role that religion could play. This has been the age of specialists, and the broadly learned man is a rarity. Velikovsky was compelled to cross the frontiers into various fields of science, archaeology, geology, and astronomy. The result was a book, prolegomenon. In its concluding pages, I conceded that more problems were raised than had been solved. That's the way with the pursuit of knowledge in all cases. You keep saying, well, you're always dangling. Well, you expand the circumference of knowledge, you got a much wider border of new questions. Now, these people who zealously affect you and seek to put you underneath their pea brain, have few questions left to answer. And to that crowd, some poor little jerk's affair in a motel 7 years ago is titillating. I think I read in the paper today that both evangelists had a fling with this girl. Isn't that what you read today? All of which she blamed on one glass of wine. You think the whole of horny mankind has lived 2,000 years in the Christian centuries and never discovered what one glass of wine could accomplish for them? I mean, this story continues to defy belief. If one glass of wine would do that, I'd corner the market. But based on the way that girl looks, I'd want all the wine first. Three bags. I conceded that more problems were raised than had been solved. And I promised. And I promised. Always reckoning with the limitations of the individual scholar to pursue my study into these fields. Two. But already the implications of the fact of great global catastrophe on the earth. That caused my critics to assert. In the words of a Harvard astronomer, thank God we've gotten way out there now, that here was the most amazing example of a of a shattering of accepted concepts on record. It's amazing how the mind can read whatever it wants into what's written on these pages. In the heat! In the heat of the debate in the press, the book was pronounced one of the most significant books written since the invention of printing. and at the same time, the worst book since the invention of movable character. Believing that an emotional atmosphere is not well suited to fruitful debate, I have entered only infrequently into the controversy. I've made short factual corrections of statements by the royal astronomer and by J.B.S. Haldane, appearing in their reviews of my book. Why would you worry about a guy reviewing your book whose initials are B.S.? And I participated in a debate with your professor of astronomy, J.Q. Stewart, in the pages of Harper's Magazine. In other words, he argued a few times, but not much. And neither did they. Now more than 3.5 years have passed since the publication of the book, and I appreciate the opportunity offered me by your invitation to present a dispassionate review of recent finds in the three fields named in the title of my address. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
In my book, Worlds in Collision, I describe the great natural catastrophes of the second and first millennia before the present era. That's from 3000 B.C. to Christ. That's the period we've been looking at. That second millennium, the period when the pyramid was alleged to be built by Khufu. Prominent place is given in my book to the description of the natural upheaval that occurred in the closing hours of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt. Now, the Middle Kingdom came to end about the 15th century. I synchronize this event with the Exodus, when sea, land, and sky were in uproar. Now, don't ask me to park my brain when I become a Christian. Once I believe in God, starting with the astounding beginning point of Christianity, that He raised Christ from the dead, and then I don't have any trouble assuming the existence of a God who's powerful enough to stop the sun, as the visual view of it describes it in the Bible. The Bible's not describing in scientific terms. He's describing the way it looks. They're giving perceptual descriptions of an occurrence. I mean, who would have more critics of the Bible? They'd say it was fraud and written in late centuries and laid out in the sun to make it look like it's old parchment. If we were to read in the Bible that the earth orbiting upon its axis stopped or slowed down until the appearance was that the sun stood still in the sky. They didn't have that knowledge. They described the way it looked to them. But scientific knowledge makes us know that something affected the orbital process of the earth to give that perceptual view. Now, I have no difficulty believing that God can cause that. The phenomenon of Joshua's long day. I get a little angry when I come to believe that God can do that. That He doesn't do it for me more often. I mean, I know lots of days that He should have lengthened, and some He should have sped up real fast. And I intend to ask God what kind of special deal Joshua had that I didn't get. I ain't ever stopped the sun yet. But don't ask me to believe that happened in Palestine and the rest of the world's clocks and view of reality was unchanged. I mean, if somebody had a long day, then somebody else had a long night. I expect a little baby boom from some section of the earth. And then the blackout in New York, population went up. That's been demonstrated. How many remember the blackout in New York? Don't tell me where you were. Or what you were doing. You don't have to confess those things to me in my church. I ain't going to tell you where I was or what I was doing. All Velikovsky is saying is he set out to synchronize with the current archaeological and historic discoveries. If these events in Exodus occurred at the close of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, then there ought to be evidence of strange physical occurrences in other cultures that it was not the job of the biblical record to take into account. The collective human memory, he says, retained an inexhaustible array of recollections of the time when the world was in conflagration, when sea engulfed land, earth trembled, celestial bodies were disturbed in their motion, and meteorites fell. My narrative is based on historical texts of many peoples around the globe, on classical literature, on epics of northern races, on sacred books of the Orient and Occident, on traditions and folklore of primitive peoples. The question that arose was, where is the archaeological evidence? This is a follow-up to his Worlds in Collision. In Worlds in Collision, he had described in the collective historic texts, classic literature, epics round the world, a collective memory of catastrophic events happening about this time. The question that arose, therefore, was where is the archaeological evidence? In later chapters of my book, I gave such evidence, water clocks and sundials that show a different length of the day or altered latitudes, change in the orientation of ancient temples which originally faced toward the east but do so no longer. I also closely examined in my book the calendars of the civilized peoples of antiquity, from Mexico and Peru to Greece, Iran, Israel, Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, India, and China. Now, of course, you know, Jimmy Swaggart, the scholar, was preaching the other day, proving that the Catholics have no right to their preeminence, which he says is based on Paul and Peter both being at Rome, because when Paul wrote the letter to Rome, he greeted everybody but Peter, therefore Peter wasn't there. Once in a while, he attempts to prove to us that he only went to the third grade. Therefore, God doesn't hear the prayers of Catholics. That Jew, or Jew, that jerk, would conclude. Once jerk, always jerk. You see Velikovsky sitting in the audience in Long Beach Coliseum, being stricken in his brain and heart with the wisdom of the gospel as presented by Jimmy the Jerk, and running forward to throw his cigarettes on the altar. seems a bit incongruous, doesn't it? Well, isn't it a put down to suggest that the rest of us have to go through that work on your routine? All this material, archaeologically, gave strong support to the literary evidence. Working independently of me, Professor Claude Schaefer, whose earlier excavations at Ras Shamra, the Ugarit civilization, caused a complete revolution in biblical exegesis, published a volume printed by the Oxford University Press. In this very detailed and technical work, comprising together with tables almost 1,000 pages, Schaefer demonstrates that on several occasions, each marking the end of an epoch, the entire ancient East was shaken and devastated. Modern annals of seismology know nothing comparable in severity and extent. The most devastating of these upheavals took place at exactly the end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, causing its downfall, as claimed in Worlds in Collision and Ages in Chaos. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
I am going somewhere. I'm going to another book. For those who just joined us, I'm reading from Emanuel Velikovsky's Earth in Upheaval. At the close of that particular book and his many books, he includes an address he made to Princeton University, which was a follow-up to his book, Worlds in Collision. In essence, he had taken issue with the reigning view of things, that all things continue as they are now continuing. The harmony and stability in the history of the universe, with rare, if any, major catastrophes, which were necessary to the harmonious unfolding of the theories of evolution. He is now giving an address after years of the book being out and creating quite a stir, which is a follow-up to his book. He says, working independently of me, Professor Claude Schaefer, whose earlier excavations at Ras Shamra of the Ugarit civilization caused a complete revolution in biblical exegesis. He sure did. It's like the digs at Ebla, brand new. And for political reasons, the scholars have still not had a free hand there. But at least they have uncovered a creation story that can be dated about 300 to 500 years earlier than the Babylonian story. And critics of the Bible had said the Babylonian story of the creation, because it was penned about 300 years earlier than the biblical record, if it's credited to Moses. Therefore, the biblical record must have drawn on the Babylonian record. But in Ebla, they find a record closer to the biblical record that was 300 to 500 years earlier than the Babylonian record. So much for scientific premature conclusions. In this very detailed work that Schaefer did, comprising together with tables almost 1,000 pages, Schaefer demonstrates that on several occasions, each marking the end of an epoch, the entire ancient East was shaken and devastated. Modern annals of seismology know nothing comparable in severity and extent to these past catastrophes. Now, the major thesis and concentration of Velikovsky's work has to do with the close of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, which recently archaeology has coincided with the exodus out of Egypt by the Hebrews. Archaeology has pushed the Exodus back at least 250 to 300 years into the 15th century. And the Middle Kingdom has been dated too far back, and Velikovsky's work has shown that the ending of the Middle Kingdom and the Exodus and the biblical record are near simultaneous happenings. He is also showing that cataclysms have been a habit pattern of this earth. And the most devastating of these upheavals in modern history took place at exactly the end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, causing its downfall, as claimed in Velikovsky's works, Worlds in Collision and Ages in Chaos. Cities were overturned, epidemics left the dead piled in common graves, the pursuit of arts and commerce came to an abrupt end, empires ceased to exist, strata of earth, dust, and ashes yards thick covered the ruined cities. In many places the population was annihilated, in others it was decimated. Settled living was replaced by nomadic existence. Climate changed. Claude Schaeffer analyzed the archaeological fields of every place excavated from Troy at the Dardanelles over all Asia Minor, Armenia, the Caucasus, Persia, Syria, Cyprus, and Palestine to Egypt and Africa. He summarizes his extensive volume in this way, quote, "Our inquiry has demonstrated that these repeated crises, which opened and closed the principal periods of the third and second millennia, were not caused by the action of man. Far from it, because compared with the vastness of these all-embracing crises and their profound effects, the exploits of conquerors would appear only insignificant." Schaeffer's work sheds a new light on the conclusions at which Sir Arthur Evans arrived after many years of archaeological work on